Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. You know, it's funny about these shows. They seem, you know, we all know the routine. It's like there's the host, me, and Maja, and we have kind of personalities, but we don't. It's not really clear what we do except do this. You know, you have the host. It's like Johnny Carson, he shows up on the show, and you don't really know. It's not like Johnny Carson wrote a book, or Johnny Carson made a record, or Johnny Carson, you know, is an architect. It's just that what he does is like in the show. And then the guest comes on, and the guest is like someone who's done something. And you define like, oh, they have a new book, they have a record, they're a yoga expert, they're a scholar, you know, and there's a kind of identity around it. And then that's sort of, then the conversation spills out of that. And, you know, I think about this because I program the show all the time, and I'm always thinking about who to have on. And so I'm looking at, like, what are some new things people do, new art shows, new books. You know, it's a good way to sort of, you know, keep in a stream of interesting people coming through, which is a wonderful challenge. But it's in a weird way, sometimes it misses something. And it misses something in the following sense, that when I reflect on all the remarkable, interesting, bizarre, inspiring people that I've met in my life, and I've been blessed to have met quite a few, there are a number of people who are rich and fascinating and some of my favorite people in the world, but they're kind of elusive. Like, it doesn't quite register to go, they're X or they're Y. It's hard to figure out what the hook is, as we would say in the kind of journalism biz, is for these folks in terms of conversations, connections, and identity. You know, what kind of identity do they have in some way that I could present as a guest on a talk show? And today's guest is in such a category, one of my very greatest friends of all time, Spyros Antonopoulos. And I'll get to introducing him in a bit, because it's sort of one of the challenges that he's a character who's explored many fascinating outlying edges of the cultures of consciousness. I mean, this is a guy who set up, or helped, you know, was involved with some folks who set up a illicit bungee jump from over the Rio Grande from I think it was about 350 feet. So an insane bungee jump that was set up on this bridge in the middle of the day, totally unethically, and then and then he proceeded to make this absolute death-defying leap. Normal bungee jumps are much shorter than that, and there's a video of this event on the web, and it's just this extraordinary experience of watching this guy do this crazy thing and come back as if from the edge of death or the edge of the outer limits of the mind, and a zone that he's explored in many ways, at varying ways since. And so I want to bring that in and bring in conversations and reflections. I guess if you had to classify Spyros as anything, you'd have to say he's a yogi. But if I say that term, there's going to be a lot of associations with that that aren't really appropriate. Things like a yogi is someone who is like a professional yoga instructor who kind of gives people some therapeutic tools to deal with the slings and arrows of postmodern existence in the yoga hall, with the sort of vague glaze of Eastern spirituality and Western self-help. And that really doesn't even come close to what we're talking about in this case, but that may be part of our challenge today, is to figure out exactly what we mean by a yogi in terms of intensity of practice, attitude. What are we doing here? What does spirituality really amount to in this crazy moment of ongoing conversation, technological breakdown, the return of microorganisms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It just goes on and on. But in addition to his explorations at the edges of consciousness and his very deep devotion to Ashtanga yoga and other spiritual practices, is that Spyro also underwent basically a kind of stroke a few years ago. So he had a major brain event as a extremely healthy, not even middle-aged guy, And this was a very striking and odd experience and terrifying for those of us who knew and loved him, because the Spiro that initially popped back on the other side of this brain event was definitely a different character with a different kind of brain. And he's worked his way back over the ensuing almost 2 years, and he's recovered. But it was this long, slow process, and a very interesting one when you take a mind, a soul that has been exploring the edges in so many ways for a while, and then you have this very significant insult, you might say, to the brain, and what that does to someone's practice, what that does to someone's self-image, what that does to someone's sense of what we're doing in the world as it slowly gets built back to quote-unquote normal, or as normal as any of us, at least any of us involved in the show, ever get. So I'm no doubt this is going to be a very interesting, perhaps somewhat experimental conversation, and I'm really glad that Spiro decided to go for it. But before we bring him on, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, the other host, the half-host, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, so you've met Spiro. You've hung out with him. Your kids have hung out with Spiro. We got mutual friends. Now, if you were, like, talking to Spiro on the street, and then he walked down the street, and some other friend just came up to you and go, who is that guy? What is he? What's his story? What would you say?
Well, I think yogi is a pretty good description, like you said. That's a really good word to use. But as you mentioned, a lot of people really don't know what to ascribe to that word. Like, they think it's just, like, a yoga teacher. But the thing with saying someone's a yogi is they're living it, man. You know, they're not just showing up to a Bikram spot, you know, once or twice a week to get all sweaty. They're incorporating it into every part of their life. And just in my, you know, conversations that I've had with him, you can tell that he's putting it everywhere in all the stuff. So a yogi is good because Spiro puts it everywhere in all the stuff.
Well, that's good stuff. So let's just move right on. Welcome Spiro to the show. Hey, Spiro.
Hi, people.
Yeah, pretty funny.
Hi, Eric.
Hi. So you're calling from Maine. You're in lovely Maine.
I'm in lovely Maine. It's a beautiful afternoon here. And, yeah.
That's wonderful. So because you have a somewhat peripatetic life at this moment. You don't have any real roots in any one particular place.
No, I'm doing the sort of wandering, it's a Dharma bum tradition maybe, but it's also like, you know, working, you know, so occasionally I get called in to do some stuff or, you know, reflect with a hedge fund yoga lineage or just invitations to meet with people and do some checking out, make tea at a temple in New York, various roles and whatever it's called.
Well, the making tea at a temple in New York needs to be unpacked. I mean, for me, I've watched you. I mean, you know, we could say a little bit about how we met, but since this is just what I'm thinking of right now, you know, I've watched you go through so many interesting experiments with technology, with occultism, with shamanic practice, with, you know, being a driven New York style designer with all these different facets of, you know, being a DJ, making music, all this kind of interesting, rich stuff. But in a way, for me, the most beautiful, almost paradoxical expression of your activity in the world, expression in the world, was when you moved from Taos to New York and you started getting really, really deep, heavy into Ashtanga yoga, very devoted student. And then you had this whole thing about tea. We could talk about tea, but just to set it up, just this image of you, and if tell me if I'm getting it right, where, like, for a while your life was kind of the following. You would get up extremely early in the morning, 2:30, 3 in the morning. You'd ride your bike to the yoga studio. You would practice alongside your very heavy-duty yoga teacher, so you do the practice together at the same time before the other students come in. Then the other students start coming in at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you start making this delicious chai, this incredible this stuff is like ambrosia. And then when people would get out of the class, they would stop, and you had this nice little social space inside the yoga studio that was kind of like a little tea stall, and people would drink the tea and create a social space. And then that would end, and you'd kind of buy the ingredients for the next day, and that was kind of your day. It was like you were like a chai monk in New York City. It was just totally beautiful.
It was a strange thing, and nothing I planned to do. It was actually the falling of the towers in New York that brought a crossroads. They're basically, Patapi Joyce was in town during this whole event, and people felt like they had to come together. And so people, you know, they had a gathering. And people are making food, and I asked Eddie Stern, who is the guy running the school and the temple that's surrounding him, and he actually brought Patapi Joyce to New York the first many times. And I said, "Is anybody making tea?" And he said, "No, you do? You make tea?" And at that point, I was actually kind of lying. I was like, "No, I don't." I mean, my friend, and I had another friend in New York who had made a lot of tea. We have hung out with a lot of Chaiwalas in Taos when we're making tea during various festivals. And he had bought me some pots before this all. And we were thinking about going in some sort of business. And suddenly this presented itself, and I said, "Yeah, I'll make tea." So Mark and I actually just made, you know, 10 gallons of tea and carried it from Grand Street to the Puck Building and served tea. And that was the sort of first time I made tea.
And that was just after 9/11?
That was just after 9/11.
That's amazing. I never knew that story. But just to let people know, Patapi Joyce, of course, is the founder and you know, Guruji Supreme, now departed, of the Ashtanga yoga lineage, which is really the, you know, that's the one that you were diving so deep into. So that's a very interesting kind of transmission. I mean, what is it about? I mean, one of the things I noticed about, like, the way that the tea stall functioned in the yoga studios, you have people come out, and it's this very heavy practice, very much internal too. It's like it's silent. People are, unlike other yoga forms, you know, the teacher isn't leading by saying what the next move is. Everyone's doing the same routine at a different pace, and everyone's just really in their own kind of current. And then they come out, and there's this gesture that tea makes that, in a way, it doesn't have anything to do with spirituality, and on another level, it has everything to do with spirituality. And it's this kind of gesture towards a kind of conversation, a kind of opening. So when you were working with the tea on a daily basis, and it was really part of your sadhana, part of your practice, what did you come to understand about tea, about what that whole process, the gesture, the ritual of tea is about?
The first thing is the smell of ginger. And, you know, it almost is like Madeleine's cookie in Proust. You know, it's that
Madeleine.
Madeleine. The cookie, that smell sort of stuck with people. And people that, you know, it's not an easy practice. And some people would roll out of bed and not even feel like going. But the smell of something as a reward, as something, as a sort of space between people's day-to-day lives, their practice, and, you know, before they ran into the world often, they would have this little space that we had set up, which was sort of performance, but also very real. That's what I did. That's how I made money, and it was all organic ingredients. And so there were smells, you know, cinnamon, cardamom, ginger, and milk and sugar. And somehow that space allowed for us to talk about what it is and what we're doing and explore. I got to read tons of the traditional texts during these couple of years and really, you know, cut my teeth in arguing with the audience about what's happening and what the various ways of looking at it through the Yoga Sutras or various Samhitas and all the traditional texts. So it was a little place to talk about what's happening. And also it was interesting. It was like being a bartender in some ways. There was a ton of different people coming through this place. There was no sign on the door. there is people from all parts of New York society. So from the super rich to the people that were just didn't know how they were making money or, you know, washing the floors there. But everybody was coming to practice together side by side without knowing each other's name, without knowing what they do, but knowing each other on an intimate level nonetheless, like somehow sharing time, sweating, struggling. Everybody sort of was on the same page on some level.
Well, I think it's important, too, to add to that for folks that don't know, like, Ashtanga yoga is not like Hatha yoga or Bikram yoga where you go and do the things. It's like Ashtanga yoga is the one where people have, like, their feet on top of their head and their eyes crossed and their tongue sticking out. Like, it's the postures in it. So when you say struggle, and I just want people to understand, like, what's happening in that room when you say, like, and talk about the chai and the scent and the struggle, the audience should understand, like, this is the kind of stuff where you're holding your entire body up with your hands and things like that. I mean, did you, in giving the tea, did you see, were people having, like, physical breakdowns at all? When I know, like Eric said, this is something that happens extremely internal because you're struggling with yourself, with your will, in order to make your body do some of these things. Is that, like, a component in your bartending?
It's a component in the entire practice. I mean, in a sense, that's what brought me to New York. I had this idea that I was going to New York to do some DJing and play at downtown places like Tonic and all these other places. And I was doing that at first, but it became obvious very quickly that either I had to, like, put all my money and time into being a DJ or yoga. You know, I couldn't stay out till 3 in the morning and wake up at 6 and practice. But and the whole getting to New York was a little bit about that's where I actually took on practice of Ashtanga yoga as a daily routine, and it was this time and space. It was like a mat, almost like a flying carpet or something, but it's just a yoga mat. And in that space, I committed to myself that I would just do the routine. I would start and I would do a little bit, and I would keep adding to it and growing a practice. And once I had set that in motion, I was committed to doing that. So it was during that time, nothing else could happen. And then there was this whole time that while doing the practice every day, you start to realize that the things that we look at outside as saying, well, we want to make this different. We want to, get a little bit of a better house, and that'll make me happy, or, you know, get some money together. All these different things were happening right on my mat. Like, all these types of ideas were coming up as I was just doing the same thing every day. So I started to realize that it's not actually the outside world that's always shifting and causing these effects. It's actually the mind. It's the relationship to the self as a body, as a someone that breathes, as someone that moves through space. And so suddenly you saw a whole different way of looking. It was like staring at a wall for 10 years.
Yeah.
And then,
well, that's part of the thing that I reflect on when I often think about when you were practicing so much and what I learned about yoga through your eyes, because I've done a lot of yoga, but I never had that kind of devoted sense exactly that you've had. And one of the things I was so interested about being in a yoga space is this weird, profoundly American mixture of secular and spiritual, of body and soul, of, you know, self-help and mystic exoticism, and it's this very interesting, like, para-quasi-religious space. And one of the things, again, that sets, you know, both Ashtanga, but even specifically Eddie Stern's studio apart, was that there was more of a sense, as unspoken as it was spoken. It wasn't like you showed up and that here's this whole riff that people are giving and everybody's using the same kind of language to describe what their religious devotion to the practice is. Not at all. In fact, it's almost the opposite. But there was also a very strong sense, partly because it was also literally a temple, like a real temple, with, you know, real deities in it. And your teacher, Eddie himself, had a stronger, sweeter, and more technically Hindu style in terms of how he was presenting some some of the tradition, but it really also came to me that that a lot of the deep spirituality of the thing had to do with just the repetition of it, not in a simple way, but in a deep way, that it was really the fact that people were coming together to be on their own, like we're looking at a wall in a Zen retreat, and you know, sort of pushing their bodies into the, you know, over and over again. But what the question I have for you is that you must have seen a lot of people who showed up, had some, they were discontent with something in their life, they're, you know, whether they were successful or not, they were, you know, searching, yearning, and they just do this thing because they hear it's cool and it seems hip and it seems, you know, good for your body and you look sexy or whatever mixture of reasons people do it. And then they start to hit these walls that deep practice brings you to and you know, also creates the context for you to go beyond. So how would you reflect on seeing this practice really, how much it really changed people, how much it just created, gave people new baubles for their ego? I mean, it's something we talk about a lot, and you were in a very interesting place to see how this practice really does transform people in some ways, but also some of the real subtle kind of traps or you know, difficulties in the practice as well.
Well, there's a lot there. There's an argument that Eddie and I used to constantly have, which was the motives of what brought you to yoga. You know, he used to be down on people that came for like a nice ass, which Ashtanga yoga would give. And I would be like, well, you know, the smell, you know, you don't know why you're actually walking in. You might tell yourself whatever it takes to get to the moment, you know, but once you get there, you shift, you know, all of a sudden you realize that I was kind of wrong. I was totally wrong. I'm actually not here to do this. I'm here because of something else. And you know, that was part of being on the mat over and over again, as you saw that shifting of the mind and the idea of reason to bring to a moment and just going through all those different things. That said, you know, someone that comes to Ashtanga yoga, you have to be committed. You have to at least commit to 3 days a week, preferably every day, which means a lot of things. You're going to be moving your body a bit. You're not going to be able to eat heavy at night. You're probably going to have to wake up and practice yoga. And, you know, so suddenly you're like, oh, gosh, if I don't eat meat or if I eat this way or eat this way, does that help? And you start to see these subtle shifts in what you bring into your body changes how you perform, how the body performs. And it's just this constant dialogue with the self and the world and sort of intake and outtake that Ashtanga yoga leaves open to a large degree, especially through Eddie. And Eddie's thing at the studio and at the temple, I think a lot of what Eddie was doing is, you know, a lot of people really looked up to Eddie, and having a sort of temple to sort of focus an energy of appreciation or idolization and those types of things could always be moved over to, you know, a deity.
Right. That makes a lot of sense, because it's funny when you think about it that way. It's this mixture of a kind of, you know, if you think of the typical yoga studio, even with all its New Age elements, as being essentially a secular space. It's not a temple. They might use temple language, but, you know, it's basically a place that you move in. You know, it's different. It has a sort of in-between quality, but it's very different than actually, here's a temple. It looks like a temple. There's a Murti of Ganesha. He was, you know, blessed by a real priest. He gets chants and flowers every day. You know, that's a different kind of space. But in a way, what you're saying is that it wasn't that the people were going there and becoming Hindus. It's that the energy of having a real temple changed the way that people inevitably in these practices kind of idealize or project or enchant the teacher. And that's what you see when you go to like normal yoga studios. And there's this weird mix of self-help, body physicalism, and New Age chakra energy chant stuff. And it's this weird blend. And one of the things you notice is that these teachers become these very kind of charismatic fetishes of some imagined, balanced, you know, life, but they're often just kind of these weird they become these kind of mini celebrities, and it's kind of a weird scene. And yeah. In a way, what Eddie was doing was like, oh, wait, if we have like an actual space there, then people are going to approach it as a temple, not by thinking, oh, now I'm a Hindu, but just by kind of displacing the energy and creating a different kind of space.
I mean, Eddie basically, you know, still calls himself a Jew that does Hindu worship, you know, but he goes to the synagogue right next door and also gives talks to the people downtown during the holy holidays and stuff. So the other thing is that the space is kind of real. There is actual energies being put into the space and putting out of the space, and it does anchor something that's different than anything else. And the other people can be a teacher for a long time. We can be very smart about it. We can be like we're perfecting situations, and we can keep the ego in check and all those things, but we don't even realize half the time when the subtle shift happens. Like I was doing a lot of practices with yoga, and somehow it came very smoothly to me, the actual physicality. So some people that basically have a dense idea of identity, basically, that if you can do crazy poses, that somehow signifies that you're more spiritual. And that wasn't necessarily the case. But still, I knew that on some level. I could go to India, and I could do... go for a couple months and practice, but never really want to ask the teacher for papers to teach or anything like that. I just was actually trying to be almost to a fault, kind of pure in the movement. But I could see, you know, at some point you start to appreciate that people look at you in a certain way. Like there's an affection there too. So you're kind of like suddenly a part of me was holding a pose just a teeny bit longer because wanted somebody to see me or something like that. So there's like these subtle forces of ego that eventually crawl in naively and actually for a sweet feeling, but it's still, once it's there, it sort of captures, it's there.
Yeah, it's a really...
It's a phenomenon, and I would see that happen a lot in martial arts as well. And what would happen is, this is the thing, like you can direct that kind of energy in a certain way. Like if someone could hold some crazy thing for some crazy amount of time, in martial arts we would do push-up holds, you know, where you go on your fist and they would have contests to see who could stay up on their fist the longest. And so it became like this thing with people, right, where everybody wanted to be that person that was like the winner, that could do it, that could break through the thing. But what actually happens is when someone can do that crazy pose for like so long, it's not just like they're looking at you with affection and adoration because you just did something that was like seemingly impossible. So now you can become this source of inspiration so people know that's something that can happen, right? Like they just saw something that is like ridiculous. They're like, they can't do. So it actually can have the effect of bolstering the entire community when like the teacher or one person that gets to a certain level can do it. It can like catch on like fire, and then everyone kind of feeds on it. But when one person just takes it as their like thing, like their Superman, then it gets like kind of ridiculous.
It's just also very subtle of a shift. Like you may actually conceptually understand all the mechanics of that. I mean, this is true for me. I totally understood. I kept this all very disciplinedly at bay. But subtly, I couldn't help but notice that there was this sort of, like, just a subtle, like, guy that, like, really liked that. That really liked to be the guy that, like, people liked. And, you know, you can't fault the guy because it's actually part of human nature. So it's a very subtle shift that eventually happens. And then, you know, if something happens where it becomes threatened, you know, you notice all these things come up, these challenges in the subtle realm of just a practice and people looking on at that.
Well, given that is part, like for you, that's clearly part of what the practice is watching how these subtle forms of ego enter in and then how you deal with those and how you reframe it. And it seems like there's always this kind of dance between continuity and discontinuity, like the thing you're doing and you're doing it and it's happening and it's real, and it's like, and then there's like a kind of attachment or an ego that gets involved, and then it's like, well, let's break out of that or crack it or reframe it in a way or undermine it in a
or
way to open
just
up
get kicked state. Out or somehow you just land in New Jersey.
Yeah. Well, for you, where did that come from? Where did that extra put? Is it something that's inside the practice, or does it have to do with your own, you know, I mean, you were not somebody who was going to be like, you did a lot of practices, you did a lot of exploration, but you were not someone who was going to do the same kind of practice every day and be really devoted to a very, in some ways, very constrained life for a long time, which was, you know, based on your previous life, really unusual. So what was it like to, like, kind of see both sides of that really open-ended exploratory zone and then move into a more kind of codified space that still raises these kind of issues?
Well, first of all, I didn't realize how codified it was from the get-go. From onset, it just seemed like a space where nobody's talking and you get to explore. And then subtly, as you become more sensitized to realms, and you start to see that there are some codifications that may not be inherent in the actual practice or the actual energy, the yoga energy, but it is part of how, you know, how people projected onto it and carried it. And there's a certain sense of refinement. So in the same way that expanding mind may be part of like a bipolar ideal of like if you just keep expanding, like capitalism. In the same sense, this was an exploration in refinement of this. You know, this is what Ashtanga Yoga actually is. You know, it's eight steps or limbs of various modes of refinement. The first ones, like the yamas, are ways of expressing outwardly, you know, the number one being violence. Like, what is the relationship of violence from this being outward? And then there's various, the niyamas become looking at the self and looking at the body, at the cleanliness, how it conducts itself within a structure, within a context. And then next comes the body, and as what we think of as yoga, you know, moving the body. But it's really just about finding your rest in the body.
Yeah.
Well, and then you continue on from there to breath and then to the sense organs and so on until you sort of are grasping at straw, and then there's nothing there. And I think there's a sense there, you know, like the Navajo rugs that always, you're waking a weave, but they always put a mistake in, because that's where they say the spirit enters. And so I think somehow the flaw, you know, the rupture, you know, people like break their knees or do these things. You can say you're breaking the knees because you push too hard, but that may be how they do things, how one approaches life in general. So that whole question of how it approach gives us a response, and you know, from a yogic, as yoga as energy perspective, and then you know, that dialogue is going on. Now we can just heal and do the same thing again, or we can sort of adapt and try something else.
Yeah.
Well, the breaks literally cause evolution. Like, one of the things when I was studying Yi Ching is like where the line breaks or where it changes, that's where it like transforms into something else. And the same is like with our DNA. Like, when you get like a jacked up strand, that's where evolution actually occurs. So when you incur some kind of break or there's a damage or something like that, that's what in fact like causes the change and transformation to occur, like even scientifically.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of things in the sense of transformation that also come into question, like who the self is, you know, what is the identity that that transforms, what is the structure around it. So these types of questions start ringing in the contemplative, the modern contemplative mind.
Absolutely, and they also bring up some very interesting questions about the brain beneath the mind or embedded in the mind, which I want to get to after the break we got to take now. So you're listening to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Dawu. We're talking to Spiros Antonopoulos about yoga and the yogic life, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Honesty without fear. The Whistleblowers Radio Hour on Tuesdays at 1 p.m.
After every scandal, we learned that there were citizens who tried to alert the public, but were silenced and retaliated against.
I did not grow up wanting to become a whistleblower, but it was my job and my moral obligation to demand that truth and justice be honored.
Hear from leading whistleblower lawyers about how you can protect yourself if you expose waste, fraud, or corruption.
This country would be a much better place when we all recognize the contributions that whistleblowers make to our society and protect them from retaliation.
Learn from prominent whistleblowers who lived through it.
Support those who protect you.
Whistleblowers are key to holding government and corporations accountable. Empower yourself. Know your rights.
Tune in to hear me interview some of our nation's heroes.
Tune in to Honesty Without Fear, Tuesdays at 1 p.m.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Mata Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, speaking today with Spiros Antonopoulos about yoga and all things yogi. And Spiro, when something happens in the body, a lot of folks, they're kind of clueless and they don't really know. And a lot of times things, people can have a heart attack and they don't even know they're having a heart attack. Like, that's the state of most folks' bodies, you know. They'll, like, just kind of have a heart attack and then hang out and think they're cool. But so I'm wondering, for someone like you that had spent so much time being in your body and getting to that place of stillness in your body, when you had your stroke, like, did you feel it? Were you conscious of kind of what was happening? Like, did it, or did your body just kind of take you out of it? Were you able to, like, go through it at all and feel it?
You know, it's a weird thing. There's always a pie in the face. So this was mine. And it was actually really great in a lot of ways. But it happened through, there's several different threads of story that I could talk about. But it actually happened technically, physically, on a Sunday morning about 2 years ago, probably around, you know, somewhere around now. I was doing a practice of Ashtanga yoga and doing Mayurasana, which was a peacock pose, but I actually hadn't thought about the ramifications of that until much, much later. But I was basically just got a headache. Suddenly I had a headache. And this has happened before, and usually, you know, relaxing and just moving energy through usually helped. But this didn't. This was like, whoa. And I stopped. And I decided to roll over and go to sleep. And I slept. I must have, you know, I moved over to a bed at some point. I was doing it at home in Santa Fe. And I fell asleep and woke up, and it was the next day. I somehow knew it was the next day, probably through my iPhone. And I felt really, like, I thought it was a flu. A journal. I started writing a journal about a month before this, and I had already said, "Okay, you're going to keep a journal for the exclusive case of just looking at the mind, and that's going to be your sadhana. And if you have to, you have a busy day that day, and you have to like choose between a practice of yoga and an hour of writing and looking at the mind, choose writing." So this is already in place. And so I look back, and there's some hodgepodge almost words talking about a pain on my left side of my face, a little bit in my eyes, but I still thought it was sort of like a bad sinus cold. And so I drove to the co-op and got a few things. Luckily, nothing out of the ordinary happened, or I don't know if I'd be able to parse it, but it seemed to happen pretty cleanly. I just thought, again, it was just foggy.
You were totally, like, moving around and driving and stuff.
I was, you know, I don't know exactly how it happened. And I went home, I cooked, and fell asleep, and it was again the next day. And
wow.
that was when I started texting friends and, you know, the iPhone. Like, I could tell that what I was trying for there's some disjunct going on between anything going out of my hands and thoughts and what actually intention was there. So I knew that something was wrong. And eventually a friend came and took me to the hospital. And I don't remember very much, but they say that, you know, it took all day. They didn't know what was going on. I had perfect health and eventually did an MRI and quickly changed me, got me ready for surgery. They did another MRI and saw that it wasn't getting any worse. This is, you know, this is some of the pieces that have been filled in, others telling me. But I still hung out in the hospital, and the doctor came, the neurologist, and he said, you know, in perfect health, if I go in and make a cut to drain or do something or see what's happening, it will be a scar that will last forever. If it's not getting any worse, it could resolve itself on its own, or if there's a scar, it will be the best of all possible scars. So I don't actually think, you know, for me, that's like, it was a godsend. That was a blessed move because everything was okay. It was probably good that I slept for 3 days. It's probably good that I wasn't in New York where everybody wants to cover their ass and, like, check out every detail and make sure that they found something, because if it happened again, they don't want to be responsible.
Oh, they would have just cut you open without even asking you, totally.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things to say about it. One is to recognize also that we use the word stroke, but even that is there's a wide variation of things that happen, and, you know, there's aneurysms, there's all sorts of kind of events, and partly because you didn't ever really want to pay for it, and it didn't really matter at a certain point. It's still kind of an enigma what the whole thing was in the first place.
Neurologist says it's one thing, and the cardiopulmonary guy says it's definitely a stroke. So,
yeah, it's fascinating. But I mean, what was remarkable, you know, and then I saw you shortly thereafter, and. You know, it's a very peculiar thing to have somebody who's you totally know, and you would recognize us, and you'd recognize that we were your friends, and you could feel your emotions, your heart energy was in a really sweet place, that you weren't, like, you may be a little tender, a little scared, but you weren't, like, freaked out or totally shut down. It was, like, familiar as Spiro on the heart level. But then on this cognitive level, it was like, clear that you didn't really know who we were, or if you did, you didn't really remember, and if you tried to say anything, almost anything was like garbled. It was really weird because it was like you and not you. And I mean, I've never had as clear a sense of how constructed the self is. You know, we meet our friends, people we know well, and they seem to have this consistency. Their ego or their personality has this consistency, and yeah, they're in a good mood or a bad mood, or they're up, they're down, whatever, but there's still this sense of consistency. But that sense of consistency is clearly partly just a fabrication of multiple things working together in concert over time. And when some of those things change dramatically and some of them stay the same, it's a very peculiar experience of continuity and discontinuity. And I can only imagine what it was like from you.
I'd like to share a little bit. I mean, number one was that technically what was happening was my brain had filled with blood. It was in the frontal lobe, and it sort of wiped out my idea of identity to some degree. I knew there was somewhere that, like, self was inherent, but it wasn't being labeled. So
The labels
so it eradicated
your ego, basically?
Well, I think ego was, you know, it's lower, yeah, ego but not self. So, yeah, you know, and if we look back through my journals, and we actually talk about some of those things that were going on in my life at the time, in the story of the life, it will make a lot more sense, at least it does to me. And in a sense, this was like the sadhana. This was like an ordeal that, you know, was in dialogue with the mystery of the world to some degree, or yoga, or whatever we want to call it, you know. But in this sense, labels had washed away. And so, in a sense, Ganesh at the temple in New York, Ganesh stands for names and form. And both of these were somehow in my own head. and in paper and dialogues, all were ways of parsing and protecting myself, or, you know, my sense of self from being, to some degree, from a sort of naked being of just, without protection, of just being here naked in the world and surrender. So there's a way words label something and help file it before it actually just has a resonance with us. So somehow my brain was very active in saying, oh, this is a this, and it associates to this, and that's very cool, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like a way of, like, playing, you know, badminton with the world and being, you know, just being cool. And so this was a way of all the, like, maybe every word is more like an animal that's in a zoo, and suddenly they're all let free, and I'm in this sort of luminous world where it's warm but not light or dark. There's things running through all these animals, and I don't really label them at all. I just sort of feel them, and it's all beautiful, but it's all unknown. And so there was waves of laughter and late waves of tears, and it was a very strange and beautiful time. And I was also sort of taken into this house, which I had spent the night before till 3 a.m. I had been at this house. It's a house that I call the anti-ashram, but it's just a place of nice people that took me in and sort of nurtured me for the next year and a half, and still do to some degree. So it was a place of, you know, walking around and contemplating enlightenment and physics and watching like 3 movies a day for a year while my brain recomposed.
I mean, it was also just a remarkable, you know, it sounds funny. It's almost like a kind of idealization of it. But there was a point where you reached, you know, fairly shortly, where you kind of realized that you were just going to kind of have to, you were just going to submit to this process and do what you, be where you were, and, you know, speak however coherently you could speak. And, you know, over time, you know, things were quote unquote improving, although even there you're like, what exactly is happening is an interesting question. But on an emotional level, it was really kind of amazing to be around you, because you did seem to be able to get into a place of just this kind of sweet submission and to your circumstances, but nothing fatalistic about it, and like it's almost as if you stopped struggling in on a very deep way or level that we all struggle all the time, which is, who am I? How am I going to reassert my identity? How am I going to maintain this continuity? How do I decide between this and that? You know, all this shit is going on all the time, pressurizing us, even if we have these incredible yoga practices or whatever. It's still this kind of pressure. In a way, you were lucky. You lucked out. Your karma was great. You landed in this wonderful, supportive environment where you could go through this completely bizarre process. You had no map. Nobody had a map. No one could really help you. I mean, they could support you, but they couldn't really tell you what to do. And it really became this kind of like this genuine sadhana that affected other people around you, you know. And so now it must be an interesting space for you, because you kind of can look at that partly in retrospect, and partly it's a process that is continuing. So what has stayed with you from that mind-body journey through, you know, the non-ego or the broken ego, or, you know, whatever you want to call that sort of space of real change? And as you kind of climbed back or moved back into a more conventional framework, what stayed with you as on a level of like a deep lesson, a deep sense of how the world and the self work?
Well, that's an ongoing question. There's a couple things. First of all, there's a sense when the event happened, I think part of me kind of wished I died, you know. Kind of me was like, I felt like I just had checkmated myself, and I was just like, game over, can you just like boot me out of here? And I mean, it was very subtle. I wasn't like being, you know, I was just kind of like done. I was like, this is done, I don't know what's going on. But somehow, at the same time, there were people like you, there's lots of people that texted me, sent me messages, flowers, phone calls, and there's just this idea of people that I love in the world, people, you know, love in the world, And at that point, it didn't really matter if we hated each other, if there's a big argument, or if it was very sweet, or we hadn't talked, or we do talk. All that stuff didn't really matter. It was all like, you know, well, now I use the term fireflies. But with these beings that existed at that pull us in here, and the only real reason to be here seems to share time with beings.
Yeah.
So that was an overarching, like, call. And that was more important than anything else that I could make sense of. And so, you know, I may say that I'm just hanging out with people and friends, but it's actually really kind of sacred, or, you know, not in a silly way, but it's actually just, like, as real as anything can get for me in some sense.
That's so important, I feel like, because, you know, people see all that stuff as very mundane, like even just everything you just said, like from just phone calls to whatever, is just kind of mundane. And sometimes you can be like, well, whatever, like it doesn't really matter. We're just like, what are you guys going to do? Like everyone, especially in Los Angeles, puts so much attention on what are you going to do together. But really, it's about just hanging out, man, and being there with the person, but also those ties that extend over time and space. Like once you come into contact with a person, I know this is going to get kind of new agey, but it's what you were talking about, how you can see those lines and how they solidify in those times of crisis. And no matter how much time and space there is between you and another person you've had some contact like that with, it can just completely eradicate in a single moment, in a total mundane moment like a phone call.
Yeah.
Well, it's also that there's this space that you're opening up, you know, a space of kind of friendship rather than, you know, like a guru-disciple relationship, you know. And when I reflect on my own past and, you know, who's illuminated me the most, or what situations have illuminated me the most, and some of them look like traditional, you know, or at least traditional from a wacky, you know, West Coast perspective, you know, I'm a Zen retreat or a psychotherapeutic session or, you know, an encounter with a lecturer or whatever. But most of them are really spaces of friendship where, you know, maybe my friend knows more than me about something and teaches me something. You know, here's a practice, here's a way to think about this. But my basic sense of them is that we're sharing a kind of horizontal space of a network of friendship over time, and then it's animated by things that are more sacred and more subtle and more significant than might appear on the surface, because, hey, we're just hanging out, we're just chatting, we're just throwing ideas around. You know, just the way, you know, you and I started out as friends, tossing around ideas and doing little projects together and things like that, but I'll still think of you as like a teacher in my life, even though has nothing to do with putting you on a pedestal. And I think that's a way that a lot of people actually are, but they don't necessarily realize it. And it can actually be helpful to go, oh, I thought I was just this rootless seeker who's like always looking for the next hit of something, when I actually already have this network, of real friends who that I encounter these things with.
Ruthless seeker.
What's that?
Ruthless seeker. That was really good.
Yeah, it's something magical. I think there's actually even something happening magical now in the world with the internet, and you know, the fact that we are now sharing time and space together, although we are all in different locations, and that. We have ideas about it. There's like this idea of that things are solid, and from that, you know, people build these great hierarchies and of ideas and knowledge, and that stays with the body and different parts. But like things are shifting already, and it's just our minds that seem to be keeping it somewhat, trying to batten down the hatches of a sort of shifting world.
Well, you mentioned fireflies before. Can you just riff on that a little bit? It's such a sweet image.
I mean, there's this idea, I think it's originally from, I got it from Michael Taussig, And he's talking about this liminal space around, he actually says, you know, maybe it's like California where it's not very cold and not very hot all year round. And but the idea is that these liminal times at sunrise and sunset are these times that aren't in time in the same way, and that that there's an Incan story where that before the world had a moon and a sun, before there were categorized days and nights and times of this and that, the world was inhabited and illuminated by fireflies. And so that that's become sort of a motif. I started out by talking to a friend that's a filmmaker in L.A., and we were just shooting ideas for film, doing something together. And I said, fireflies, that's why I was riffing, and she stuck on that. And that sort of illuminated the whole thing. And suddenly I started seeing fireflies everywhere. You know, at the Whitney, there's an installation by a Japanese artist that has fireflies over water. There's the story of John Glenn in outer space during the first American circling the Earth. And he did like three loops of sunrises, and during every sunrise he saw all these things he considered to be fireflies. It then turned out to be tested, and it was reflections of the sun on condensed water. But the idea is still alive that that there's these reflections, and I saw that the beings were like fireflies, and that goes along with, I talked to Eddie Stern about it a bit, and he's like, yes, you know, each of the Atman is a light.
Well, you know what, Spiro, we're going to have to end it there, but that's a beautiful place to end. Each Atman is a light, and I really appreciate you sharing your light with us today.
Thank you.
All right, from me and Maja to all you out there, keep your minds open.